It's a famous interview where Richard Williams snaps on the reporter and says, now she done said what she done said with a whole lot of confidence, you know. And I saw that in real time. And the look on Venus's face burned, that image burned in my heart, because that's how I wanted my daughter to look when I showed up. Mm-hmm. And that interview had really changed my parenting at that time. It was like the look on Venus's face, we just watched it. It was like she had a lion, and she was so confident and so comfortable that her lion wasn't gonna let anything happen to her, you know? And I fell in love with Richard Williams, you know, that was 20 something years ago.
Never has Kenneth Branagh felt so pure and earnest. Belfast might be Branagh's best work to date, which is saying something when he has quite the resume. That's from E.G. Moreno of Flickering Myth. That's right, our featured film is Belfast. 88% Rotten Tomatoes, 90% from the audience. The Oscar race has begun. Cannot wait to dive into that as far as our new releases are concerned. Also, Clifford the Big Red Dog. Yes, had to go check that out with the kids. We'll get into that in a second. Obviously, the boys were happy. Slushies, all good. Hassing, which is a new film on Netflix. Also getting some Oscar buzz. I got to be honest, I was not nearly as high on that as I was on Belfast. And as far as Succession is concerned, we're now halfway through season 3. So I want to kind of talk about Succession a little bit. And as far as our old is concerned, The Jinx, which is a fabulous 6-part documentary. I'd never seen it before. It came out in 2015. I finally binge-watched it, 45 minutes each, so 4.5 hours. Incredible documentary about Robert Durst. The best thing I can say about it is I know the ending, and I already thought it was incredible from start to finish. In addition to that, a wild card. Thanks to Ben Lyons, who hooks me up, because listen, there's a press conference for King Richard, the film which is opening on the 19th. It's going to be available on HBO Max and from Warner Brothers. Big Oscar campaign for this. Will Smith might win an Oscar. So we attended a press conference, and so you're going to hear from Will Smith, Venus Williams, Serena Williams. I believe the actress is playing those women as well, and the director of the film. So Cody, we got a lot of good stuff this week.
They all joined the show today.
Yeah.
As far as the people are concerned, Will Smith on the show today.
That's the story we're selling. You're starting to treat me a little bit like Levitard. I texted you some Mike Schur quotes from The Hollywood Reporter, and you completely ignored it. Now, it's okay if you ignore it. Just give me a like, because that way I know you don't care. You're just like, I'm acknowledging that I got it, but
is that what that means?
Less.
The thumbs up is kind of just like, enough with you.
Correct.
Thank
it's
you.
Acknowledgement? Like, my phone's not broken, but I don't care. I have no comment to offer. I'm just liking it. Cool. I sent like three.
I'm bad. I need to get better at texting. This just so you don't take it personal.
Sure.
Everybody in my life complains about me being a bad texter. Okay. I you know what I do is I mentally respond. I like see it and I'm like, oh, I have a thought on that. And then in my mind, I think I responded. And then like an hour later, and then it turns into 5 days later and I'm an asshole.
No, I think you go by importance of text. Like if it's something related to taping, you're like, boom, I got you right away. But it's something like kind of off the beaten path, you don't care. Although you responded to me texting you during Monday Night Football. I'm like, dude, I'm sure you guys have done this on the show. Didn't realize that Matthew Stafford is your doppelganger. And you wrote back,
that is,
why thank you.
I take that as a compliment. Matthew Stafford, I look at him and say, that's a good looking guy. Yeah. I've never gotten that before. He's not really a ginger.
He's
I don't
not
know
a
what
ginger,
you're doing
the
there, but I'll take
complexion.
It.
I was like, oh, and plus you got a good arm. I'm like, all right, Matthew Stafford, Chris Cody, that's how we're doing this. The 200th episode of Cinephile is going to come in a couple weeks. This is great news working for Metalark. Not to blast Cadence 13, my former employer, but we never get to take a week off. Like, you're never missing an episode. This is insane. I go, what if I want to just go see my family in Toronto? You're doing it? You're doing 2 episodes. And I go, God, so I'm doing twice the work. I don't know. It was ridiculous. Joe would take vacation to Minnesota. He's from Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Joe would be grinding at episodes. I'm in Toronto. It's ridiculous. So I asked Cody, I'm like, hey, Thanksgiving. He's like, dude, we're good. Thanksgiving, we're fine. Christmas, we're fine. Go ahead, do whatever you want.
Meadowlark, baby.
Oh, by the way, speaking of Cadence, my episode, the latest GM Shuffle, interview with Stevie Van Zandt. If you're a Sopranos fan, you're going to want to listen to this. He talks about, you know, being cast as Silvio, stories from David Chase, Lilyhammer, of course, being a part of Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band. So check that out, the GM Shuffle, my NFL podcast with Michael Lombardi. So episode 200 is going to be coming up early December. We're going to record that November 30th. The big guest is James Andrew Miller. You know him, of course, he wrote ESPN, Those Guys Have All the Fun, the CAA book, SNL book. He's written a new book about HBO. It's coming out next Tuesday, the 23rd. Cody, guess how many pages it is?
600.
975 pages. He's saying, I'll do your podcast. You have to read all 975 pages. Like, oh my, is there going to be a test? Like, this is unbelievable. So
I feel like we could tighten it up. Tighter. Just, I feel like from Knocked Up. He's just like, no, you don't have to lose weight. Just tighter. Just get it.
I'm just empty the tank. 900. If you're wondering what I'm doing during Thanksgiving, I'll be reading 975 pages of Tinder.
We're gonna take a week off so Adnan can read the book.
What were you gonna say? That you had a comment. You were gonna jump in on something.
I was going to say about the Will Smith thing today. Maybe we can address this later on, like when we get to, when we're teeing this up, because I'm interested, like, in the Will Smith dynamic as a movie star, because he's kind of like, he was as good as it gets, and then he's kind of just like, he's tailed off a little bit. Yeah. So I'm just like, I just find his career path interesting.
I love it. We're going to do a little Will Smith trajectory. He's got a new book coming out as well. I mean, there's some powerful stuff in there about his dad abusing his mom. So yeah, this is definitely a time to be talking about Will Smith. Before we get into Belfast, one other bit of business to do, and that is, I need your Monsters Ball review, because when I discussed it on the podcast, you had seen about 30 minutes, and then you finished it after that. So now we need Chris Cody's edition of Monsters Ball, a 20-year anniversary. What are your thoughts? Because now I spoiled the book. Oh, what, you make me feel good. Make me feel good. Like, now you got what that means when Halle Berry
and Billy epic won. Sex scene. Yeah. An epic sex scene. And you know why? Because it felt like it was real life. You know, a lot of times these sex scenes, they go from 0 to 100. They're like, let's have sex, and then all of a sudden they're having sex, and it's like, how did that happen so fast? This one, you really lived in the moment in this sex scene, where it's like, they took, like, it wasn't just like, oh, they're thinking about sex, boom, sex. Yeah. It was like, you got to see, and it was just, and it was awkward, because that's how sex can be, right? Like, we're not all Ron Jeremy, which is a terribly old, terrible, I don't know,
no, it's a good, I didn't think reference. I'd be referencing. Our audience will get that, yeah, our audience will get
but you know what I mean? Yeah. But like sex, it's not pretty all the time. Am I right, Adnan?
I'll give
I just felt like, overall, though, I didn't think after watching the first half hour that I would be able to find a redeemable quality in Billy Bob Thornton's character, but I did. You know, the movie, I was like, this guy is so terrible. There's no way I'll be able to say anything good about him at any point in this movie. But he kind of turned it around. I liked the movie. Like, I know this is how Chris does it around here. I just say I liked it. But it's got everything. It's just a good all-around movie. And I can tell why Halle Berry won an Oscar. She was great.
And you like the fact that he eats chocolate ice cream with a plastic spoon, which is a really Billy Bob Thornton thing. He's terrified of metal.
I do. I love little, like, stuff like that. Like, that's one of those things that in the first scene, I'm like, this ice cream thing is going to be a theme with him. Yeah. Like, I could just tell the way he ordered it. I'm like, this is not going to be the last time that we're talking about ice cream in this movie. Yeah. It was just, I enjoyed it, man. Great movie.
Puff Daddy, Mos Def, make sure you check out Monsters Ball, 20th anniversary. There it is. Don't take my word for it. Take Chris Cody's word for it.
That sex scene. Woo.
Why'd you make me feel good? Now we get to the business at hand. Kenneth Branagh's Belfast, a love letter to his youth. The celebrated actor and auteur who is adept at Shakespeare or such underrated directorial efforts is dead again. A Hitchcockian horror film made earlier in his career, grew up in Belfast, and has now made this love letter to the locale of his youth. The movie has earned raves at film festivals, and according to GoldDerby.com, a site for which I used to work, Belfast is the favorite to win Best Picture at next year's Academy Awards. And it's easy to see why. It's a family drama, which is about a very specific time and place. The movie follows the adage, to make something universal, you must make it specific. It's a similar blueprint that one of the best movies of last year followed, the drama of Korean immigrants, Minari. The movie opens with an idyllic scene, children playing outside, set to the music of Van Morrison. More on Van in just a second. But then the fairy tale ends as gunfire erupts and tanks arrive. This is the time of IRA violence, as religious warfare is fought between Protestants and Catholics. The young boy at the heart of the film, ostensibly a young Branagh, is the precocious Buddy, played with infectious charm and wit by newcomer Jude Hill. His parents are Jamie Dornan as Pa and Katrina Balfe as Ma. They are well-meaning, but far from well-to-do. In fact, Pa is feeling the squeeze from local gangsters looking to make a cut and have him leave the neighborhood. An Irish family in dire financial straits? Yeah, you've seen this before in Angela's Ashes or Brooklyn. But they aren't poverty-stricken, and it isn't overdone, even when Pa has to work in England and then return to the family when he can. Buddy has his sister Moira, who he can pal around with, and then there's Catherine, the object of his affection. But the real heart of the film is his grandparents, played with undeniable warmth by Dame Judi Dench and Ciaran Hinds. They are kindly and affectionate, just not as quirky as the great-grandma from Minari, who loved American wrestling and had a potty mouth. These grandparents have the twinkle in their eye and dispense homespun wisdom. If it all sounds a little cliched and familiar, well, in some ways it is. But there's also no denying the elite craftsmanship on display. From the luscious black and white cinematography to the gorgeous framing of Branagh's camera to the Van Morrison collage of music. This is a beautiful film which has a ton of heart. In a world of bleak-eyed cynicism, Belfast is a reminder of why we go to the films in the first place, why we go to movie theaters. It's escapist fun, but also has a conscience, as the bittersweet ending demonstrates. May we all have the fondness of youth and a showcase with which to tell it. Everlasting love, indeed. We still have 6 weeks left, but it's indisputable for me. So far, Chris Cody, Belfast is the best picture of the year.
Leader in the clubhouse. I mean, that's big for you. Like when you hear a movie's a leader in the clubhouse for an Oscar, like I imagine you, like you get so excited.
I was, and I was giddy going into it because you hear all these rave reviews and you go, okay, I mean, how much of this is just people losing their minds? Not every film that's getting rave reviews is good. And then all of a sudden you go, wow, I can totally see why. You're swept up in the experience. And like I said, it's so much better being in a theater. When you're at home, you have distractions, you're checking your phone, kids, etc. Here, it's an immersive experience. And like I said, from start to finish, I appreciate what a gorgeous film it is. Hour and 40, it's not very long. I want a couple thoughts here on Van Morrison. Wall-to-wall Van Morrison on the soundtrack. We've seen this before in movies. You know, Amy Mann was in the soundtrack for Magnolia. It's all her songs from Paul Thomas Anderson. Now, here's what's amazing. It's a great Van Morrison soundtrack. I wouldn't say I know a ton of his music, but his three most famous songs, not in the movie, Brown Eyed Girl, Wild Night, and Moondance. Let me tell you something. Wild Night's about as good as it gets. Like, I'd like to learn bass just to do Wild Night. Like, John Mellencamp does the revision with Michel Endige Ocello. Fantastic. But he uses Days Like This, which is a great song. That was in As Good As It Gets. But I always find it interesting when a director says, you know, I'm just going to use the music of this one artist. Having said that, I thought the music was fantastic. Trust me, on the way home, I was listening to Wild Night. I cranked it up. Van Morrison is also a guy who I believe has written a song called End the Lockdown. Noted anti-vaxxer. Just crushing governments all over the place. So it's a little bit like the 10% tarnished as I'm dancing to the music. I'm like, yeah, this guy is a nut. Like him and Eric Clapton are fucking batshit crazy right now. But hey, I love Van Morrison's music. This guy's great.
Van Rogers.
What I wanted to ask you this, though. If I was to ask you, could you do an Irish accent? Because you are known for doing impressions on the show, you and Mike Ryan. And I'm watching Hour 40 of Ireland, Belfast. What do you got for me?
Hi, laddie. Hi. Lucky charm. Oh, my lucky charms. They're magically delicious.
Jeez. Because the only thing I could do is... You know, the movie In the Name of the Father, Daniel Day-Lewis, and Pete Postlewaite, who is amazing. There's one scene you see in all the Oscar clips, is when he looks at Daniel Day-Lewis and goes, "Don't you be lying to me. I can see the truth staring me in the face."
Oh, yours is much better. Mine's too cartoonish.
yours is definitely a leprechaun. Mine's just trying to be rooted in actual belief. But listen, I think it's a wonderful film. I hope everyone goes and checks it out. Like I said, there's a reason why it's getting all this kind of love right now. As far as the Oscar race is concerned, who knows? Like I said, the next 6 weeks, a lot of these Oscar movies are going to be big, particularly King Richard. As you mentioned, you're going to hear from Will Smith and company coming up. In the meantime, let's get to a couple other things here. I want to talk about Succession, which is one of the best shows on television. My friend Cab was like, trust me, you're going to love this show. It's completely your sense of humor. I said, why am I going to watch a show about a bunch of white people who are rich and elitist? I'm not going to relate to this show, right?
Yeah.
But in reading about it and just the origin story, so to speak, it's like the Murdoch family, but King Lear. I'm all in on King Lear. Okay, we're going to have this profane king. He's just, you know, looking at these children who are absolutely useless. He's got these children who are a mess. And we're going to have a complete show of dislikable characters. And somehow, some way, Adam McKay, and I think particularly Jesse Armstrong had pulled it off. Adam McKay, of course, we all know, very famous director, collaborated with Will Ferrell, many films. But Jesse Armstrong, the writing on this show is so acidic. Here's a small sampling from season 3. At one point when Tom is talking about the fact they're calling him Terminal Tom, and he could be going to prison soon, he laughs and says, pretty soon I'm going to be sucking off ogres for phone cards. Later on, Kieran Culkin, when he criticizes Kendall after what happened, the father says, you tried to kill dad with the son again, didn't you? Do you have a fetish for trying to kill dad? This is the third time you've done it. Later on, after Logan comes back to big health, Shiv is trying to bother me. He goes, can you just fuck off? And she says, well, someone's feeling better. Even at one point, Kendall, when he's calling into a conference call, when you have to give your name, it's, you know, this is Chris Cody. He says, Lord Fuckleroy. And then at the end of the call, when the call does not go well, all you hear is, Lord Fuckleroy has left the meeting. I'm like, This show has so many great one-liners. That is just a small sampling of, like I said, it's acidic, it's acerbic, and it's brilliant. And they're halfway through season three right now, 5 episodes in. Succession is the kind of show where it took a few episodes for them to kind of find their footing. I think by episode 3 or 4, they were good. And episode 5, they were flat out flying. As a matter of fact, I think Adam McKay even said one time, episode 5, he thinks is one of the best hours of television ever. I think that's where they try to get the coup on Logan.
Of season 1 or
of
this
season?
Season
1. So okay. I think, you know, many shows, it's hard to hit the ground running. Obviously, look at any great show, The Sopranos, Breaking Bad, NYPD Blue. I mean, it's hard to just come out of the gate firing. So Succession took 2 or 3 episodes, but once they got their footing, season 1, I think, was rolling. And season 2 was even better than season 1, start to finish. And now we have season 3, which I just think has been solid start to finish. It's a reminder as well what HBO does. And we'll talk to James Andrew Miller about this, but you don't always have to have stars. You know, Brian Cox is a well-known character actor. If you really know your movies, you're like, okay, I saw him in Rob Roy. I saw him in Manhunter. He played Hannibal. Lecter.
Super Troopers.
Super Troopers, sure. Like, he's definitely an actor you've seen, but he's never been a leading man. He's the star of the show. But then you have all these other actors, you know, Jeremy Strong and Kieran Culkin and Sarah Snook. Like, these are not well-known actors, but HBO makes stars. When you have a great collaboration like that, it's made these people into household names.
You just hit the nail on the head on why I haven't watched this show yet. I started to watch it the first episode, yeah. and to your point, you said it starts a little slow, so yeah. It didn't really keep me. Yeah. So I guess I got to go back to it and give it a chance. Mm-hmm. But Jeremy Strong, do you ever just see an actor that just rubs you the wrong way?
Oh my God.
It's just like, I don't know. There's just, I can't even think of anything else he's been in. It's just this Jeremy Strong guy. Oh. He just rubs me the wrong
way. We're sharing a brain. I remember because the first year it got nominated for a bunch of Emmys, and then it won for writing. And you're right. I remember watching the Emmys sitting at the table of Jeremy Strong's face. I'm like, who's this guy? Like, why? Okay.
It's just
like, this guy's carrying the
show. Does he have a punchable face? Is that what I'm doing?
Yeah, I think it's like, kind it's of a just, punchable he just, face. He looks
I don't
great.
Know. Maybe I've seen him in something else that I subconsciously hate him for. I have to look at his IMDb because there's just something about Jeremy Strong.
I want you to tweet a cinephile pod. Is there just something about Jeremy Strong, which I hope is going to be the podcast title, because I think Chris has nailed this. I had the same aversion to seeing his face, a punchable face, a smarmy face, kind of like just a dick. But then I got to tell you, I watched the show. The guy's phenomenal. He's an unbelievable actor. I hope we get Jeremy Strong on the podcast one day. I'll apologize for judging him on his face because I think he's a huge talent. He's a big Daniel Day-Lewis guy. He was an assistant to Daniel Day-Lewis early on in his career.
Explains it.
Dude, this guy is very immersive. Method acting, but I love him. Jeremy Strong, in fact, won an Emmy Award for his performance. That's how good he was, best actor in season 2 of Succession. So if you haven't seen it yet, trust me, I don't want to spoil anything, but just think King Lear, think Murdoch Family, think great, great fun. It's delicious, it's witty, and remarkable ensemble cast. I like the directing as well. It also is the best opening of any show on television right now. The opening credits and the music by Nicholas Britell with that piano, I mean, it's rare. You know, some shows now, they just start the show. There's not even opening credits. The opening credits of Succession, as good as we've ever seen in television history, Nicholas Britell, obviously Adam McKay and Jesse Armstrong doing a phenomenal job. So 4 Maple Leafs for Belfast, 4 Maple Leafs for Succession, and now we'll dive into a couple more before we get to our special guest, Will Smith. Passing is currently available on Netflix. The alternate title I will give it is Listless. This is not the film that I was looking for. This got rave reviews. Rebecca Hall, who's an excellent actress, she debuted this film at Sundance, as a matter of fact, and it got rave reviews, and the story is very provocative. There's no question about that. It's about two women. One is black, one is white, but the one who is white is actually black. She's passing off as white, which is how the story gets its title. So it's very interesting the way that the whole conceit came about. I believe it's based on a book which was written in the late 1920s. Tessa Thompson, who's always a beautiful, strong screen presence, she plays the woman who is black, but you know, and sees her old friend, Ruth Nega, who is passing off as white. And you have a very jarring scene early on in which Alexander Skarsgård, who is the husband of Ruth Nega, who is passing as white, who tells them both just how much he despises Negroes. It's just like, just hate-filled language of what he says. And you see Tessa Thompson's reaction. She just laughs. What else can you do? This person is spewing such vitriol, just to laugh it off. But she wants nothing to do with her friend, and yet her friend comes to her and confides in her and says, listen, you know, it's not that I regret the fact that, you know, I'm not black. I mean, I like my life. I'm passing off as white. I've got a great husband, but there's something missing in my life. So they start to draw a connection together, these two women. At first, I'm like, is this like a same-sex romance kind of thing, or is she just longing for her? The good news is you got Bill Camp in the movie. I love Bill Camp. He's so good. He was in The Night Of. He always seemed in these supporting roles. He plays the owner of the one shop where they work at. But ultimately, this is one of those stories which I think the book must be fantastic. I'd love to go read the book in which it's based. And again, I did like the fact black and white. Two films in black and white. Two new films. I love the photography and it's beautifully shot, but ultimately there's just not enough story. There's not enough meat on the bone, which is why if you see Passing on Netflix, I'd recommend all of you just go ahead and keep on passing. I'm going to give this one 2 Maple Leafs. All right, Clifford the Big Red Dog. Let's get this out of the way. How much were the tickets? Whole family went, okay? My wife came along for the ride this time, so she really wanted to see. She loves Clifford. Who doesn't love Clifford? The guy's a freaking big red dog. $71 to go see Clifford the Big Red Dog. Okay, snacks, $39.75.
So there were actually workers taking your money, yeah. And like there were people at this movie theater actually doing
on a
job.
Saturday night. And normally this is not my local AMC. This is the one in Ridgewood. Nice little, you know, classic old theater. I was shocked. Normally I go there matinee, no one's there. This is a Saturday night, 6:30. I'm like, oh my God, there's like a line. There's actually like a concession stand. There's actually ticket takers. And you go in, it's a bunch of families watching it. But $110 to see Clifford. Like, I mean, think about this. Someone says, I'll ask you, Cody, what was your Saturday night? I spent $110 to watch Clifford.
I mean, that sounds like a Saturday night to me. Nothing says Saturday night like going to see Clifford the Big Red Dog. I mean, $100, I mean, that's a whole family. If you would have gone to dinner, you would have spent more, okay? Yeah, I mean, it's a night out. You're not going to get that matinee price all the time, Adnan.
No, it's a good point by you, Cody. No, listen, Belfast, $8.50. I mean, $8.39 was incredible. So listen, sometimes you get robbed a little bit. I get that. Clifford the Big Red Dog, I'm going to give it 2 Maple Leafs, okay? I'm giving passing 2 Maple Leafs. I'll give Clifford the Big Red Dog 2 Maple Leafs. I don't know how much Clifford I've read. I'm sure I loved him as a kid. I mean, I just know he's a big red dog. The scene where he becomes a big red dog is amazing. Like this little
what
girl.
Is the story behind so it? Because I just know it as like you flip through the pages, yeah. And you see a big red dog. Right. I don't know what he's about. I don't. Is he a nice dog?
Great dog. The little girl adopts a small. Like, it has a reddish hue.
And does he talk?
Doesn't talk. She wakes up one day, okay. And just sees like he's an elephant in her room. She's like, oh my God. And they just starts running all over the place. And
that would be terrifying.
Oh, my God. Like, it was a huge laugh out loud moment when the guy who's looking after her, babysitter's like, ah! Like, it was the best physical comic. What do you do? There's a gigantic. And he goes, there's a monster. There's a creature. He doesn't even realize it's a dog. He just thinks it's like a fucking Loch Ness monster. Like, ah!
What do you call, like, the fire department? Right. Like, who would I call with, like, a large dog?
He sits in the bed, breaks the bed. He's starving. He just eats like 100 burgers. The best thing is, imagine playing fetch with this guy. And that's what happens. They go to Central Park. You got one of these guys in one of these like big rubber balloon type things. Boom. Clifford's off and running. And then you get the most disgusting scene, which of course my kids loved. You see a tree and you go, oh no, here we go. Just gigantic urine gushing towards the tree. Like, oh. Like imagine the dumps that Clifford the Big Red Dog is taking. Like this is a gigantic dog. You do have a cast of charming actors. Tony Hale, who, of course, is amazing. Buster on Arrested Development. He plays the bad guy in this. Also Emmy Award winner for Veep. He just shows up, enjoyed the paycheck. Russell Peters is in there as well. Russell Peters, very well-known comic from Canada. He's of Indian descent. I have a quick Russell Peters story for you. So there's very rare to Canadian talk shows, right? There's never been, like, you know, really great stuff like Letterman or Leno, Colbert, etc. But there was a guy named Mike Bullard. Nice enough guy. He started a talk show called Open Mic with Mike Bullard. It's on the Comedy Network in Toronto. So it's me and my buddy Hussein. It's 1996, first year at Ryerson University. We're going to go see Open Mic. And we go there. I'm like, you know, he's doing his jokes and whatever. And the camera cut us at one point because we're pretty loud laughers. And he had a pretty good line. We were dying of laughter. But then he went with like a risque joke, something about like brown people or terrorists or something like that.
Oh, no.
And they cut again to us and we looked stone-faced. And I'm like, oh my God. And then, of course, we had no idea that they were cutting to us. Like, I think we must have like some intuition. Like we recorded the episode, like, hey, maybe we'll get on the show. Because there's maybe like 200 people in the audience.
Yeah.
Now, they got us rolling in laughter and then just stone-faced. I'm like, oh my God. And then after, we did meet him, which was amazing. Like he came out. Remember Leno used to walk out and shake hands? At one point, Bullard did that. And we're like, hey, we just want to see what's up. We're actually our first-year students at Radio and Television Arts. We'd love to be, you know, broadcasters one day, want to see what's up. And he was like, oh, you guys friends of Russell? We're like, what? Because we just thought he was being insensitive. Like, oh, because Russell Peters is brown, we must know him. Like, we're families. No. He goes, when Russell, like, there's a lot of people from Brampton, Mississauga, like, Russell has a lot of family members. Like, yeah, okay, sure.
He was, like, defensive. Like, no, yeah. I swear I didn't mean
I wasn't like, oh, okay, well, what a surprise. The brown guy here is the brown. What, he his cousin? I'm like, no, it's not.
We don't all know each other, okay,
correct.
Man?
So afterwards, we meet Russell Peters, who was great. We're like, bro, we're big fans. You're so funny. He's like, thanks so much. Years later, so this is 96. Now it's 02, and I've got my first job on air doing a show called Bollywood Boulevard. I'm working at Omni, and Russell Peters is a guest on another show called Ishtar, which I'm guesting on. And I see him in the hall. I go, hey, man, not sure if you're going to remember me, but 6 years ago, my friend Hussein and I were watching you do stand-up open mic with Mike Bullard. He's like, ah! And I swear to God, he actually remembered. Because I could tell he wasn't bullshit. He was like, no, I remember.
That's awesome.
Because he said, how's Hussein doing? He goes, I remember this. And then Hussein actually became an entertainment reporter. He hung out with Russell Peters in Winnipeg like 5 years later. And then when I got on ESPN, Hussein somehow ran into Russell Peters like, hey, do you know my friend is on ESPN now? Like, remember you met him? And he's like, that's your friend? That's the guy? Yeah, that's the guy? Like, ah!
So that's awesome.
Long way of saying it was awesome to see Russell Peters is in this movie. He has the role as the brown neighbor. He has maybe 12 lines. If I still kept in touch with him, I'd like to know how much he made. Probably $10,000 for this. It'd be great. So it was nice to see Russell Peters. I mentioned Tony Hale. Clifford the Big Red Dog. Good little family film. MLK. Spend $110 at your local theater and go take your family of six and go enjoy this movie. Two Maple Leafs, Clifford, the Big Red Dog. Now it's time. Go ahead.
You are single-handedly keeping the movie theater industry. Right? Like, I don't know anybody that goes to this. I mean, obviously, you have this podcast, right. So you kind of have to. Correct. But it's just like, I commend you for how often you actually go to the theater.
I appreciate it, man. Like, it's like when people say, hey, put your money where your mouth is. But Adnan is definitely doing so.
Yeah.
Verk is putting a small fortune towards
$110. I mean, shit.
On June 14th, your favorite emotions are back on the big screen in Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2.
It's time to greet your team, Riley!
It's anger!
Let me at him!
Fear!
Safety checklist is complete!
Disgust!
Ew! Ew!
Sadness is in the house!
Oh, no.
Hello, I'm Anxiety. I'm one of Riley's new emotions.
Disney and Pixar's Inside Out 2.
There's a part two?
We're going!
Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested. Only in theaters June 14th. Get tickets now.
All right, so as far as our new films are concerned, again, to recap, four Maple Leafs for Belfast, you get four Maple Leafs for Succession, two Maple Leafs for Passing, two Maple Leafs for Clifford the Big Red Dog, three new films and a series, but we also have an old film as well. No baseball, I'm just cranking out content. A six-part documentary series, 45 minutes apiece. I sat down and watched 4.5 hours of The Jinx, The Life and Deaths of Robert Durst. Pretty rare, Cody, when you can watch a documentary, you know the ending. Like, I already know what happened, and I still was riveted from start to finish. If I say to you, Robert Durst, do you have any idea what I'm talking about?
Types his name into Google, Robert. No, I don't.
What I'll do is the Dallin Cuff spoiler alert, in case anyone doesn't know the story, because I know the story. What happened was, Robert Durst is a guy, talk about a guy you don't want to be friends with, okay? Everybody around him dies, okay? That's what it's called, The Jinx, The Life and Death of Robert Durst. His first wife, who he meets, ends up dying. Like, oh my God, Jesus, horrible story. She just disappears. We just obviously assume that she's dead. He's called in for questioning, whatever, he skates. But you have homicide detectives and investigators are like, no, I'm pretty sure Robert was involved somehow. I don't buy his story. Okay, that's part one. Part two. Oh, there's another woman that died. Robert Durst, after his wife died, dated this girl who was a part of the mob. Her dad was in the mafia. And then she died. I'm like, okay. And then the third part of the documentary, there's another person that died who Robert Durst was neighbors with. And you're like, okay, at one point do you say, is this just incredible bad luck? Or is this
Plus,
guy a
don't we all know three people that have died? I mean, geez. We're all a jinx.
We're close to a guy. Right. A wife, a girlfriend, a neighbor, it all happens to all of us. I've given plenty of time now for the spoiler alert. So what happens is it builds to this. And I already knew the story. I mean, if you have to be under a rock not to know this. 2015, the story came out, The Jinx, which is an HBO documentary series, in which Robert Durst, and this is the biggest nightmare of anyone like me and Chris Cody, getting caught with a hot mic.
Jeez.
And I didn't know the exact details. All I knew, like if you asked me like literally a week ago before I rewatched this, what happened to Robert Durst? I'm like, I know there was a documentary about him. He was accused of killing people, and he got caught with a hot mic. I'm like, what happened on the hot mic? I'm like, I know he, whatever. Something happened that he admitted he did it. So now when I actually watched the whole thing, I'm like, oh my God. So like I said, first episode, wife dies. Second episode, girlfriend dies. Third episode, neighbor dies. Fourth episode, they start to get evidence, right? Fifth episode, just the whole family dynamics of this guy. Where did he come from? Ludicrously rich, like incredibly rich, but ostracized from his family. Brother wants nothing to do with him. New York real estate, etc. So just like obviously a creepy, weird, alienated guy. And then you get to episode six, which is amazing because now Andrew Jarecki, who is an incredible documentarian, he's one of my favorite documentaries of all time. Mark Simon, got to be a fan. Capturing the Freedmans, all right, best documentaries ever. Crumb is my favorite. I love Hoop Dreams. We're trying to get Steve James, by the way, on Cinephile. Maybe it'll happen. But Capturing the Freedmans is incredible, and this is the same director, Andrew Jarecki. Now in that documentary, you don't see him. This time, though, you actually see him talking to the documentarians, and what happens is they get Robert Durst's handwriting, and they also have the writing of one of the body parts that was given to the coroner. So it says cadaver, and Beverly in Beverly Hills is misspelt. And they also have a package that Robert Durst had written in which Beverly was also misspelt. Beverley. And that moment, Cody, like, holy shit. So the guy who submitted a body part wrote this, Beverly Hills cadaver, and now you have, it's like, and like he takes it to a handwriting specialist. Like, what do you think? He's like, yeah, the B's pretty close. The V's close. It's all, they're also both misspelled. So they actually show it to Robert Durst's old attorney. This is like he charged the case 10 years ago. Hey, we have some new evidence to show you. What do you think about the way that these two are written? And the look of the attorney just kind of stares like, Like, he does not want to say, okay, I defended a guilty man. He's kind of just like, you know, what's interesting. I can see some similarities, but I can see some differences. Like, I can't say
it's
for
not,
sure.
It's not like there's an X in the middle of the word. Like, you know what I mean? Like an odd misspelling. Right. It seems like a couple of people could misspell it that way.
Right. It's true. Beverly, after you know someone named Beverly, like, okay. And it's like, but it's a jarring moment because this is how it ends episode 5. And there's 6 episodes total. Like, oh my God. So that 6th episode, he's like, I've got to get Durst back. So you see him calling him like, hey, Robert, can we do one more interview? We just want to do some other stuff. And he's like, oh, hey, Andrew, I'm actually going away. Going to like France this week. No. Like, oh my God. He's on to them. He knows. And then he's sitting there with his collaborators. Like, I think we're done. Like, I don't think he's coming back. Like, really? Like, I don't think he goes, the way this guy works, he's like, I've interviewed him so many times now. He's like, I think he's pretty smart. Like, I think he senses this, right? Like, he may have killed people, and he knows when someone's on his trail. Like, that's it. So eventually, miraculously, Robert Durst is actually arrested himself for shoplifting. Like, the guy's a moron. Like, for a guy who's a genius, he's also an idiot. So then Andrew ends up corralling him back, and they have this moment where he's interviewing him. And, you know, he says to him, and he's telling the camera, like, I'm nervous. Like, I've known that this guy is dangerous, and I don't know how to react with him, and I got to be on my feet, and, like, we'll just see how this goes. So he's going through it very pensively. It was amazing. He's sitting side by side. He goes, hey, well, I just want to show you this stuff here. And by the way, he soft shoes it earlier, like, hey, look at this picture of you and your ex-wife. And Robert Durst is like, oh, my God. It's like a 70-year-old guy. He's, you know, he's out of it. He's like, oh, that's a beautiful picture. Can I keep this picture? He's like, yeah, you want that picture? Go ahead. Yeah. Here's another picture of you and your white girlfriend. I found. Oh, by the way, look at this handwriting. And it's a long pause. When Robert Durst looks at it, he's kind of like, it's misspelled. He's like, yeah. He goes, the Beverly's missed, but this is something that you wrote. And this is the note that was given with the cadaver.
Jesus.
Just, like, and then I'm like, oh my God, what is going to happen? Is Robert Durst going to kill him? He pulled a gun, like, okay. And he just keeps staring at it. It's kind of like, yeah, that is odd. And he's like, dude. And like, what is the interest?
Did he ask a follow up? Was he like,
did you write the note?
You?
Yeah. Like, what's the follow up? He's just like, because the question is, what do you think? He's like, the guy misspelled it. Yeah. But like, is that, he goes, well, I didn't write the note. He goes, okay. So that was not your running. He's like, no. I'm like,
oh man, my skin is crawling. Like, and I'm not even watching it.
Oh, and then like, you know, they wrap up with something else. He's like, okay, we're good. He's like, all right, sure. He goes, all right. Is it good to see you again? He's like, yep. He's like, I'm just going to use the restroom. I'm like, okay. I'm like, oh my God, this is how he gets caught in the hot mic. So it's just a shot of the room and they've all left now. And it's just, you know, lights are being taken down. And all you hear is him in the bathroom. Thankfully, you don't hear him urinating. And all you hear him is saying, oh, man. Well, they caught you
to
now.
To himself?
And he said, what? Oh. Yeah. He's muttering. And he goes, what have I done? Pause. He goes, killed them all, of course. And that is the last thing you hear in this documentary. I'm like, oh, my God. Now I know why this was such a phenomenon 6 years ago.
That is wild. Like, so, and this is completely real? Like, that is, like, legit. Like, that just got caught? Like he wasn't doing that? Like, that seems like something from a movie, the way a killer would get caught.
Oh, it is. Right. It was, like, too true to be true. Like, they looked at the handwriting, show it to him. He just goes, it's misspelled. I'm like, yeah, but anything else you notice?
Oh,
like,
God.
Kind of looks similar. And he's like, oh, I didn't write that note. Like, all right,
I got to check that.
And then, while taking a piss, I mean, literally, just go to episode 6 on HBO Max and watch. It's a 36-minute documentary, the last episode. Watch the last 6 minutes, and you'll see the scene that I'm talking about. You'll be like, oh, my God.
That's awesome.
This is the amount of tension is insane. And that's when he gets burned, getting caught with a hot mic. Imagine Levitard says something stupid, and he goes to the bathroom, and he gets caught with a hot mic. Oh, my God, Dan, you can't say that. Everybody can hear you. They're all listening right now.
I can't tell you how often. Not that, like, you know, we're talking about things. But, like, you know, sometimes we're talking about things, and it's just like, there's a lot of mics in here. Like, we're always just like, maybe we should walk. If we're going to talk about this, not that we're, you know, it's just. It's so weird having a conversation, even if you're not talking about anything salacious, just something that you wouldn't want other people to hear. It's just like, man, there's just mics staring at me right now. I don't know that they're not on.
Oh, there's a private conversation. Yeah. You don't want it to be public. Simple as that. You're right. It doesn't have to be anything bad. I remember years ago, like, I cursed off air, and the director said to me, like, hey, just be careful. Like, even in a commercial break, like, your microphone's always on. Like, somebody might hear you, and they could put that out there. I'm like, hey, you're right. So, like, when the microphone is on, don't swear. Don't say anything offensive. Like, just think that you're always on.
Especially if you've
Robert
killed
Durst
people.
Did not take that logic.
Especially if you've killed people. That should be noted.
The Jinx. The Life and Deaths of Robert Durst, a 6-part documentary series. It's currently available on HBO. 6 years later, I finally saw it. If you didn't want to get spoiled, fine. But like I said to Cody, you can really Google it. I believe the latest is this. I think Robert Durst is now facing trial, and Andrew Jarecki, the documentarian, is going to be called as a witness. I think they were going to reopen the cases, and then COVID happened. But
why would he agree to do interviews? Why would he agree to do that documentary in the first place? I mean, that makes me feel like he's innocent, because he can't be that dumb. It's like, oh, I did these things. Great. I got away with it. Now I'm going to do an interview about it for a documentary.
You're right, and I think it must be. Listen, I'm just guessing what killers are like.
He wants the attention. He's like,
but probably they just think they're so. He loves the attention, and they think they're so smart. Because what Jarecki did is he did a movie called All Good Things, which stars Ryan Gosling, which I haven't seen, and that's about the Robert Durst case. So that movie came out, which the documentary shows, and Robert Durst apparently saw it, and then called Andrew Jarecki. Goes, hey, I really liked your movie. By the way, I'm Robert Durst, and Jarecki was like, oh shit. You want to chat sometime? He's like, yeah, great. Let's have a coffee. And then it was like, oh, can I film you and ask you a few things again? Whatever you want. So to your point, why would you even agree? Like, that's the ego. That's the need for attention. And, oh, this guy made a movie about me. He's probably a good dude. I can fool him, too. But just hearing the hot mic, you've been caught.
Goosebumps.
What have I done? Killed them all, of course. I'm like, holy.
It's almost like he's a schizo. And he's just like talking to himself. Like, what'd you do? You killed them all. It's like, geez, that's so creepy.
Oh, well, here's what's so brilliant about the filmmaking. Episode 4 ends, and they're doing their interview, and at the one point, Jarecki says to Durst, you want to take a break? He's like, yeah. And they keep filming, like, why are they still showing this? He's having a glass of water, and he's mumbling something to himself. He's like, you came in that day, and then he was talking to you, and blah, blah, blah. And the lawyer walks over, Robert Durst, and goes, they can hear you. And he goes, what? He goes, and the subtitle reads, your microphone's always on. They can hear you. He's like, oh, okay. So when you're watching it, I go, oh my God, this guy, this is just his life, right? There's people you know that talk to themselves. Robert Durst talks to himself. He was warned by the lawyer, episode 4 and episode 6.
Oof.
He completely admits
that's
cool. Killing people. Check out the
murder's joke. Not cool, but that sounds cool, that story.
All right, King Richard. On the next episode of Cinephile, I'm going to review King Richard because it's opening in theaters November 19th and on HBO Max. How about this for a little tease? Let's hear from Will Smith, Venus Williams, Serena Williams, the actors playing those girls, and the director of the film, King Richard, right now.
We are going to be having a mix of questions that you all have submitted. And I'm going to go ahead and start this with the two ladies that really start this movie. Mm-hmm. Venus and Serena, I just have to ask you, what emotions are you feeling seeing your family's journey being told in a motion picture with your father being played by none other than Will Smith? Mm-hmm. And Venus, I'll start with you.
Oh, okay. I was looking at Serena, how do you feel? But I think it's super emotional, and I've seen the trailer, I've read the script, and every time I watch it, my eyes are just watering. I think it was amazing to see the family atmosphere on the set, and how much Demi and Sanaya like really acted like Serena and I, even when the cameras weren't rolling, like holding hands, and it was so sweet.
Yeah. Serena, what about you?
Yeah, it's honestly, no word describes it better than just surreal, you know, just to see these incredible actresses and everyone behind it just putting this all together and about our dad's journey. But because of myself and my sister, it really is like, wow, really? Okay, is this like, are we really something, you know, kind of thing? So it really is super surreal for me. And then to have Will play this role as my father and the way he just embodied Richard Williams, it just took the whole film to a whole new level. It's so emotional, it's well done, and it's a brilliant piece of work.
I will say, audience haven't gotten a chance to see it, but the critics are already raving about everything that you guys just said. And Will, I mean, I just have to ask you, what was it about playing, you know, Richard Williams that really appealed to you? Because you fought a long road to bring this to folks.
Yeah. You know, it was really, we were talking earlier, and there was an interview that Venus was doing. How old were you in that interview?
Like 13. 13 or 14.
Yeah. And it's a famous interview where Richard Williams snaps on the reporter and says, you know, now she done said what she done said with a whole lot of confidence, you know. And I saw that in real time. And the look on Venus's face burned, that image burned in my heart, because that's how I wanted my daughter to look when I showed up. Mm-hmm. And that interview had really changed my parenting at that time. It was like the look on Venus's face, we just watched it, and it was like she had a lion. And she was so confident and so comfortable that her lion wasn't gonna let anything happen to her, you know? And I fell in love with Richard Williams, you know, that was 20-something years ago.
Wow.
And when the opportunity to be a part of this came up, that was the first thing that I remembered. I knew I wanted to show a father protecting a daughter like that to the world.
Wow, that scene is beautifully fictionalized and redone in the movie, and it is a moment that, you know, always brings audiences to clap. I've seen it twice now, and everyone claps in that moment. But Sanaya and Demi, the other dynamic that I just thought when I was watching it for the first time is these young, incredible, talented actors were, you know, given the task of, I have to do Venus and Serena. And just the idea of speaking to these ladies today made me, like, shake a little bit. So I'm just curious what those conversations were for you, and how you brought authenticity of them as not just players, but sisters. And Demi, I'll start with you.
Yeah, to bring everything together and make it feel as real as possible, I think Sanaya and I just did a lot of research. You know, it was really important to us that everything we did was real, you know, because this is not our story, this is theirs. And so, yeah, research, the internet. We had Miss Isha there every step of the way. And yeah.
What were your first conversations? Did you get on a Zoom and say, I just want to say this? I'm just curious.
With each other?
Your first conversations with your counterpart, like the first time you got to speak, like, again.
Yeah. The first time that I got to speak with Serena was when her and Venus surprised us on set. That was such a fun day. so much fun. You know, but when we spoke, they kind of spoke to us about everything but tennis, which was actually kind of funny. We spoke about their life and their childhood and about the people that they dated growing up.
Well, we wanted to make sure we were portrayed in the right way. The script took a turn.
You know, it was just a cool conversation, and we just got to speak to them as people. You know, Serena and Venus, you guys are two women that I've looked up to my entire life. So it was really fun to get to know that side of you.
Will, I'll bring it to you. But this is not the first time you played a father on screen, but it has to feel a little different. But as an actor, as a father, sort of taking on to this, you can't help but maybe compare it to your own experiences in fatherhoods, similarities and differences. What did you do when you sort of made that calculus looking at Richard's parenting style and sort of comparing it to your journey through fatherhood?
You know, one of the first things that was interesting in our first meeting, we sat down and Venus said, you know, it's almost like they brainwashed us. She was like, because you said it was like our punishment was that we couldn't play tennis, right? Because they never had to push. It was like that there was a Jedi mind trick that it was like, it wasn't the standard thing that you see of a parent pushing and driving a child. There was that, but it was augmenting and throwing fuel on a fire that they had. It was a fire coming from inside of Venus and Serena. And, you know, any for me as an actor, when I take a role also, I'm taking it to explore something. I'm taking it to learn something. And that was a new parenting idea for me of aligning with your children versus directing your children. You know, and it was a very, very different concept and approach that was magical in the Williams family, that the rules were set, but the rules that were established were divine rules, right? So faith was at the center, and then there was a collective journey we were going on. It wasn't that as a parent, I know and you don't, so you're gonna do what I say because I'm right and you're little, right? And it was a very different approach that was, you know, somewhat eye-opening for me. My father was military, so it was very different. When I was growing up, the kids don't, you don't get a vote. Mm-hmm. Right? So you do what's laid out for you, do what's established for you, and there, you know, some benefits to the, that mindset also, but this was a very different thing.
Yeah, I grew up in a military household too. It was yes ma'am, no ma'am, and the idea of agency, I don't think I got until my 20s. Right. Probably not even still.
Keep it real.
It was true. What the screenplay was not, Isha, I am sure you saw in very many previous iterations and attempts, and being, I think, a lot of folks' first contact when they're like, oh, I think I can do this. I know that your journey through to finding this story and knowing this one would be the right with the right group of filmmakers was an interesting one. And so I would be so interested to hear about that. And not so much about those bad screenplays, though.
There were really no bad screenplays. It was definitely a journey. It was persistence of definitely Tim and Trevor and wanting to tell the story of my dad and not have it be one of vilification, but one of just getting people to understand, you know, who he was as a father and like what he wanted to do and how the family came together to be able to do that. And when it was understood that that was what we wanted to happen, it became a lot easier to get behind it. And so then was the process of actually going to my family, you know, after reading the script. I was like, you know, there's this opportunity, there's a script, it's a little raw. There's some things that we can definitely finesse and get right. But this person is behind it and we have a lot of respect for Will. And he wants to get it right, won't do it unless, you know, we're really bought into the idea of what this could be and doing it right and being authentically ourselves. And that took some time. you know, because that vilification aspect is still out there and being able to trust that this group of people, this filmmaker and this production team and everyone would do this the right way. When oftentimes in sport, obviously you get one chance at it. Mm-hmm. You get one time to step up to the line and serve that ball for that point. So to want to make sure it was right and the story was told right and it was fair and it was honest. And it really displayed the integrity that we've always tried to have as a family. It took some time to get there with my family because there was a little bit of distrust, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
You know, being in the public eye for as long as they have, Venus, I think the first article was like when she was 10, yeah. eight or nine, maybe 9 years old.
Yeah.
In the Compton Gazette. So like to be written about since that age, you know, and not maybe have people understand what that family dynamic was like. Oftentimes, Lindra and I have people asking us, are you guys really close? Do they fight, you know, off the court? You know, so years and years of that, you build up a little bit of distrust. So we got there because I did trust that as long as there was going to be a footprint there every day, and I might have gotten on a couple people's nerves on set, but it was important for me because I had a responsibility to my family to make sure that the story was told right.
Well,
there was only one day on set where Isha just had to put her foot down. You remember?
Oh my gosh.
What happened?
So you remember the day where you guys were coming out and it was the your motive.
Oh,
my God. So there was a thing.
She was like, you're still doing it wrong.
It's like, you're molded, you're corroded, your booty got exploded.
No, like, that's what we got.
No.
And she came up, she was like, all right, hold up.
She was like, your booty can't got exploded.
Right. And we were like,
got exploded.
Right.
Your moody corroded. Your booty exploded. It just exploded. Your booty can't got exploded. Please, come on.
The details. That is what wins Oscars. So I appreciate you, sis, when we take home all these trophies.
Like, hey, y'all.
Look, Miss Isha's very serious. Booty's gonna explode. take the got out.
Right. Well, I appreciate that. Jokes aside, Venus and Serena, I'm sure you guys are grateful for that. Those little details. That's what you're going to, I think, enjoy more so than the story. Like, you know, the way that the table was set up, the way the beds were set up. That's the thing I think that's the personal attachment to it. But as this movie goes around the globe, you two have already inspired an entire generation of women, black, young black women especially. What is one thing you hope they see from this film? Because we all know media travels farther than any sport figure ever could. You know, people remember the movie before they remember the book and so on. And so I'm just curious what you hope young girls watching this take from this story. And Venus, I'll start with you.
Yeah, anything is possible. And to always believe in yourself, never doubt. Doubt does nothing for you, but the same time you're doubting is the same time you can spend believing in you and putting the work in, so that way you do believe and build confidence. And as a family, you can achieve anything. And that's what I really loved about this, is that it's a family film. And like Will said, or if you don't even understand tennis, you understand family. Mm-hmm. And that with a family, you can do anything. Some of us are born with that. Some of us have to create those families. But surrounding yourself with family can take you higher.
I just want to say one Sanae and Demi had to learn how to play tennis like two of the greatest tennis players of all time. So I, you know, when I had to try to learn how to play Muhammad Ali, I know how daunting that was. There are professional fighters who can't move and play like Muhammad Ali. Yeah. There are professional tennis players that can't, you know, play like Venus and Serena. And, you know, I was watching Sanaya, and I just want the world to know, not only did Sanaya learn how to play like Venus, Sanaya is left-handed. She learned how to play with her off hand.
Wow.
She learned how to play like one of the greatest tennis players of all time with her off hand. I was like,
incredible.
I was like, yeah. I was you know, and you know, just you know, when I step on a set like that, I take it as it's my responsibility. It's my family. It's my crew. It's my people. It's my, you know, it's my place. And you know, it was just such a beautiful thing to watch. You know, with Ingenue, the scene in the kitchen, we didn't really even find that till it was like the day before when we were starting to get that. And Ingenue was so confident, and it was a little more, just a little more. And it was really like day of when she was like, you know, that's it. Wow. That's it. And I just loved that push. I loved being able to serve that. I love being able to be a part of creating in that way, and that push and that tenacity, and for the authenticity and everybody in this group, you know, and to say to the three of you, everybody in this group is amazed and in awe of your family. And it was a beautiful honor and an absolute pleasure to bring this depiction to the world. So thank you for your suffering. And thank you for your hard work, and thank you for your inspiration to the world.
I mean, how good was that, Cody? If we really wanted to fake things, we would have had like me actually asking a question or two, but you did a fantastic job putting together the best of that press conference. I feel like, listen, I was already excited for the movie. Now I'm really pumped up.
Is this going to bring Will Smith back? We kind of touched on it earlier. Like, what happened to Will Smith? real quick, we don't have to spend a lot of time here. Just like, how do you evaluate his career? Because he had that stretch of just like dominating the movie. He was the guy, and now he's kind of like, you know, concussion.
Concussion, like, disaster. Boring movie. Yeah. Nobody cared. I love Albert Brooks. Albert Brooks is in Concussion, which, as you know, on Curb, he was saying, oh, Concussion's currently on Netflix. But yeah, this is a guy, listen, very famous popular rapper, no question about that. Fresh Prince, fantastic comedy, you know, sitcom star. Segues towards movies, all right, 6 Degrees of Separation. Ali, fantastic, Oscar nominated.
Bunch of good comedies.
A bunch of good comedies. Obviously, Hitch. You get your axe with Hancock. But I think you're right. There was kind of a down spin. Like, hey, it's hard. You're in your 40s. How do you still stay relevant? How do you stay this big movie star? So it's interesting.
I'm honestly surprised that he got this gig. Like, it's almost gotten to the point where it's like, you put Will Smith and say he tried to do the Marvel thing a few years back. So it's like, I'm happy for him. I'm like, this seems like a role that fits him. Like, I want him to be Will Smith again. And I'm hoping maybe this role will do that.
Yeah, he's an incredibly likable guy. Everyone always says, you know, media speak to him, our fans, like, oh, he's a great dude. Jada Pinkett Smith, the marriage's been a little bit up and down and stuff. Like I said, he's got a new book coming out, so hopefully check out the book. But I'm with you. Will Smith may not be as star-studded as he once was, but I'm telling you, rave reviews for the movie. I cannot wait to review it next time on Cinephile. 200th episode is coming up. We will also hear, just like, you know, like Ghost of Girlfriend's Past. It's like, you know, the ghost of the past, present, and the future. We will have previous members of the Cinephile family making appearances on our 200th episode. James Andrew Miller, author of the HBO book, maybe some people from the Levitard Show. Cody, this is going to be a huge show.
Yeah, let's leave it a little, like, let's just tease the people. Let's not give them too much.
We don't know exactly what's going to happen, but it's going to be awesome. Thank you for all your support.
It's going to be special. It's going to be special.
Apple Podcasts, subscribe, rate, and review, and I'll see you at the movies.
Happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. To serve others in ways that promote human flourishing and create a ripple effect of transformation for generations to come. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.